You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Bill Rothschild, a practicing attorney in Atlanta with personal experience of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement in Atlanta. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This has been a dramatic week in the Jewish world after the shocking hostage takeover of a small Reform congregation near the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport in Texas last Saturday. The 12-hour ordeal in which four people were taken hostage, including Rabbi Charlie Citron Walker, ended when the last three hostages escaped and the gunman died. As you probably know already, the events took place during Shabbat morning services at the suburban Fort Worth Synagogue, small service, when a man who'd come in off the street, a British Muslim with a history of mental health issues, suddenly waved a gun around and threatened to kill the congregants if a celebrity terrorist imprisoned in a nearby penitentiary was not freed. The Coleyville, Texas temple was live streaming its services when the attack took place, and part of the terror incident was streamed live on Facebook. The rabbi was well known in the community, having been there at that synagogue for 16 years ever since his ordination. He was also highly active in interfaith work with Muslim and Christian clergy in the area and well respected, making the attack all the more distressing. It is a great blessing that none of the hostages were injured or killed. We can also be grateful that Rabbi Citron Walker had gone through active shooter training in a variety of ways and knew best how to handle the traumatic situation. Apparently, at the end of the standoff, with the building surrounded by security teams from a variety of law enforcement agencies, local and national, the rabbi threw a chair at the gunman, and the last two hostages were able to escape with him through a door. Several aspects of this sad event have emerged in the days following the Coleyville, Texas attack. First, there is a re-emergent post-pandemic serious danger to synagogues, any and every synagogue in America, following the relative quiet of the past 2 years since the Poway Temple attack and 3 years since the Pittsburgh Tree of Life massacre. Prior to 2018, there had never been a single fatal attack on a synagogue in the United States, and very few violent attacks on temples overall. But the idea that shuls are a target for such terrorist acts has now penetrated the consciousness of evil people in this country, and apparently other countries. This terrorist was a British citizen born in the Punjab region of Pakistan, and we've become more obvious targets for such horrible acts. While everyone was locked down or doing services just on green screens during the pandemic in their own living rooms, there wasn't much opportunity to take over a Jewish congregation at prayer or make some sick point or murder its worshipers. The fact that congregants are now assembling in person more frequently opens up sick possibilities to anti-Semites again. Rabbi Citron Walker did everything they train us to do in security consultations from the Jewish community and local law enforcement extremely well. That probably kept the three people at services and himself alive and made the end of this story much better than anyone would have predicted. Thank God and thank the rabbi. So what exactly does that mean for synagogues going forward? Simply, that we will need more and better security in America, as synagogues around the world have had for decades. It certainly does not mean that people should avoid going to shul. We have the capacity to provide better protection for Jews at prayer than we have needed until now, and that means upping our game and the resources that are allocated for that purpose for the foreseeable future. You know, I remember serving as the assistant cantor at the ripe old age of 23 in Los Angeles at a major conservative synagogue in the mid-1980s. I had to get past several layers of security just to enter the building. Then it was the fear of Palestinian terrorists attacking a Jewish congregation at prayer or study. Today, that concern extends to attacks by extreme right-wing terrorists, like the perpetrators in Pittsburgh and San Diego, to unhinged Islamic fundamentalists, and to left-wing extremists who just hate Israel. In a way, it doesn't matter who shows up at your shul with a gun or a bomb or pretends to have that and threatens your people. You need to have serious security to prevent them from getting in. I've attended services and toured synagogues all around the world. In general, they all have more security than anything we have at most temples in America, including much more active involvement and protection from local law enforcement. It's common to see carabinieri protecting shuls in Italy, military forces protecting Passover seders in Peru, multiple bulletproof glass security checkpoints for temples in Greece and Turkey and even Australia. It's a sad fact of life today that people at prayer can be attacked so that sick men can make some sort of perverse political point. But in a day and age in America when nearly all school children are being trained in active shooter responses and every school has lockdown procedures, you know, one of my bar mitzvah students remembered going through exactly this sort of armed attack incident 2 years ago right here in Marana, Arizona when he was in the fourth grade. Well, this terror attack shouldn't really come as a surprise to any of us. A final note on the Coleyville, Texas incident. A few days after Rabbi Citron Walker was rightly proclaimed a hero internationally for his thoughtful and brave actions throughout the 12-hour ordeal, it emerged that back in November, his contract was not renewed for the coming year by the board of his synagogue, the same one he had served for 16 years. I must say, this rabbi job is a very challenging business today. Long-standing, devoted, careful service may not guarantee tenure. Dedicated, effective work at a high level, scholarship, talent, and serious professionalism may not ultimately keep you in the congregation you serve. My guess is that Rabbi Citron Walker will land in a good place and that Coleyville, Texas will regret letting him go. But after working as a congregational rabbi for about 25 years now, I must admit that the complications of serving a synagogue can be, well, complicated. I am extremely grateful that my own congregation, Beit Simcha, has chosen a different course than so many temples do, that it's a very good place indeed to be without all the complications that seem to come with most rabbinic positions. Anyway, to play us in this morning in the spirit of the solidarity of the Jewish people, so necessary after last weekend's events in Texas, and so important always, here's an upbeat song, Ivri Anochi, sung by Benny Friedman. I am a Jew, and I'm proud of it.
בכל מקום ובכל ארץ לא רוצה שיהיה אחרת יהודי אני זה משהו נצחי בני אברהם יצחק ויעקב בני ישראל רבקה רחל ולאה בני אברהם יצחק ויעקב בני ישראל history I've been through ask me where I'm from and I will tell you I'm a Jew and every Jew's a proud Jew not just me my sisters and my brothers never be ashamed to be a proud Jew it's not what you've done it's how he made you so sing this song and spread the pride around you Yehudi ani eternally
Hey Abraham Yitzchak V'Yaakov B'nei Sara Rivka Rachel V'Leah
Yeah.
last weekend, we commemorated the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. When we return on To Jewish in a Moment, our guest, a good friend, Bill Rothschild, a rabbi, but professionally a successful practicing attorney in Atlanta, shares some stories of growing up in Atlanta and knowing the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., well, and his father and his wife, and a lot about the Jewish community there and its involvement in the civil rights movement. Hear from Bill Rothschild when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Bill Rothschild is a rabbi, but a very successful practicing attorney, maybe a more honest line of work, I don't know, in the Atlanta area and a good friend. He's had extensive experience with the Jewish community in Atlanta in the civil rights era and coming forward. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thanks, Sam.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have you, and it's just a week after the Martin Luther King weekend, just 6 days after his birthday celebrations. Tell us a little bit about your own involvement in all this.
My involvement is that I was very young and watched things. And here's what I'd like to talk about from that. The generation, the kids that I talk to, think of the civil rights movement is something that began on the streets and in the lunch counters in the late 1950s after the Brown versus Board of Education decision, Supreme Court decision in 1954, that outlawed segregation in public school systems. And their heroes are generally this post-World War II generation that took to the streets, folks from Atlanta or who came back to Atlanta. Friends, all of them, Martin Luther King Jr., born 1929, Andrew Young, 1932, John Lewis, of blessed memory, recently died, 1940. What folks today don't learn is that these men and women stood on the shoulders of the generation before them, and these were the soldiers who came back from World War II. And it was their raw courage from the late 40s and 50s on that warmed the climate to change and gave these younger folks the room to operate. And that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about it through the lens of one of them in particular. His name was Jacob M. Rothschild. His friends called him Jack. He was born in 1911. In Pittsburgh. He was actually a war hero. He was a rabbi, a chaplain in the army on Guadalcanal in 1942. And he shows up, he gets the pulpit in Atlanta in 1946. He befriended a younger Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta King, he and his wife Janice, when they came back to Atlanta in the 1960s. And he was looked at in the black community as the white minister that had always been with them and in whom they could trust. And I got to watch all this because he was my dad.
Incredibly important story. And we'll hear more from the inside of that experience with Rabbi Jacob Rothschild, your dad, when we come back here in a moment on To Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue, well, newish Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson, the Catalina foothills, celebrates a wonderful array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation, again, just newish, we're 3 years old now, in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning every week, youth and adult education academy courses, resources, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for in-person Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org. We welcome both members and guests in our sanctuary safely but in person. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675 for more information about Beit Simcha. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ida Road on the north side of Ida, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. In our own building, services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. You can email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services with full music at 6:30 p.m., Saturday Shabbat morning services and Torah reading at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org, or email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in person and on Zoom in blended format. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our wonderful religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses in person and on Zoom, all of our services live and on Facebook, our Shabbat dinners and Torah, Tikes Shabbat, and all kinds of great stuff, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest-growing Jewish congregation and community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, jewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, twojewishradio.com. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen. 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about a very far north Jewish community, the Jewish community of Norway. We started last week describing Tromsø, I guess, which is, that might be the farthest north a Jewish community has ever existed. Certainly one of the farthest north places. Although it's not, there's no existent Jewish community there now. Let's talk about the places where there is a Jewish community and a little bit maybe about how the Holocaust played out in Norway.
So the history of Norwegian Jewry is full of surprises, many of which are due to the fact that for most of modern history, Norway was not an independent country. It was ruled either by Sweden or by Denmark, both of which we think of today as these peace-loving, quiet, gentle countries. But
they're Vikings.
We forget that, right, they are the source of the Vikings who invaded much of Europe, including Sicily. And they threatened Constantinople at one point, and they took over Normandy. And
yeah,
then
the
eventually
Norsemen,
the Normans
Normandy, right.
took over England.
England, right.
So this was, these were very militaristic, expansionist, imperialistic people. The Swedes had a huge empire at one point. The Danes, less of one, but still they kind of took turns ruling over Norway. And during this period before Norwegian independence, which didn't happen until the 19th century, Jews were not allowed to settle in Norway, with one glaring and perhaps surprising exception. Jews had been thrown out of Spain and Portugal, or their direct descendants were allowed to settle, because somehow those Jews who always came across to Ashkenazic Jews as thinking they were better than everyone else also convinced the ruling authorities that they were somehow better than Germanic Jews, and they were allowed to settle. So there was a community of Spanish and Portuguese Jews in Norway dating back many centuries. By the 19th century, when Jews were more welcome, a lot of Jews came from Germany, Central Europe, Eastern Europe, and the community became overwhelmingly Ashkenazic. When I worked for the World Union of Jewish Students in the mid-70s, I remember spending some time with the chapter of the Norwegian Union of Jewish Students, which wasn't huge because the community was never huge, but it was active and it was very prosperous and very comfortable. They felt well integrated. I remember going to one guy's house, and it was the first time, I think I might have stayed in that house actually, because we didn't have money for hotels. It was the first private house I'd ever been in that had a sauna. And it was not a small sauna. It was a sauna that could easily accommodate 25 people. And that, I think that was part of our program, was we did something like Saturday afternoon or evening. We all sat in a sauna together, which is a
nice way to spend Shabbos. Huh?
It's a very Nordic thing to do.
Yes, indeed.
Actually, a lot of Nordics I know were born in saunas. So, and let me speak for a second to the difference between Nordic and Scandinavian, because Americans tend to use the two interchangeably, which is a mistake for which you could easily be punched out by a Finn, especially if the Finn were in his cups.
Which happens often, I might
say. Right. So the Scandinavian countries are Norway, Denmark, Sweden, and in a certain technical sense, also Iceland. And these countries speak languages that are mutually comprehensible and that are Germanic languages. They're clearly close relatives of German. And if you exclude Icelandic from the group, because they live on an island far to the west, their language evolved in some different ways. But Swedes, Danes, and Norwegians have no difficulty at all understanding each other. I mean, when they get together, each speaks his or her own language, but there's no need of an interpreter. Finns, on the other hand, come from a language group called the Finno-Ugric group of languages, which includes only Finnish, Estonian, and Hungarian. And the theory, at least, and it's supported by DNA studies and history, is that the Huns, when they invaded from East Asia, some went to the north and settled what are today Finland and Estonia, and others went to the south and settled what is today Hungary. Although it's not called Hungary in Hungarian, it's called Magyar Ország. But our term Hungary obviously comes from Huns. So, more on this next week.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then.
Look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Dr. Klugman calls his patient, Mr. Goldstein, and says, "Your test results came back, Goldstein. I'm afraid it's not good." "Give it to me straight, Doc. How long do I have to live?" says Goldstein. The doctor answers, 10. 10 what? Goldstein says. 10 years? 10 months? And the doctor answers, 9, 8, 7. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. Not like Goldstein. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Mishpatim includes as many laws as any part of the whole Torah. After the last few weeks of spectacularly dramatic portions featuring some of the greatest highlights in the entirety of Jewish tradition, indeed in all religious history, Mishpatim could be seen as a major letdown. Last week, amid the smoke and thunder of Sinai, we received the Ten Commandments. The week before, God parted the sea for us, and we miraculously crossed on dry land. And in the weeks before that, 10 plagues struck the Egyptians, and Pharaoh and Moses had their duel of wills in the desert. But Mishpatim is nothing but a collection of laws about how to interact with other human beings. Civil legislation. How exciting. How to handle someone else's property fairly. How to assess punitive damages for a man who injures another person or destroys someone else's property. How to act when someone puts his or her property in trust with you. The laws of manslaughter, of theft, of damages. Boring laws, many of them detailed tediously. And no one really likes reading law books, do they? If the Torah is truly our fundamental moral text, this is an array of detailed legislation about human interaction that seems so trivial as not to belong in the Torah at all. So why is Mishpatim here? Most human beings have no love of law, or even of lawyers. But without laws, without enforcement of them, we fallible creatures wouldn't function well at all. In fact, the Mishnah tells us we would tear each other apart. Where anarchy reigns, justice cannot. And that's where Mishpatim comes in. For we need law, and we need limits, although we might not like either one. Judaism understands that if we are truly to be good or truly free, then we must observe the laws and rules of human decency, embodied in the code of legislation that makes up Mishpatim. Before we can love another human being as we love ourselves, we must respect that human being's property and person. Before we can make this world holy, we must treat each other with civility. It is a great fundamental lesson we seem to need to relearn in every generation, perhaps especially in ours. A final note, at the end of this week's Parsha, after all the rules and laws, the torts and talionises, God reveals a glimpse of the divine essence to Moses. Why is this here? Because Mishpatim teaches that we can only experience real holiness when we begin by respecting our fellow men and women, when we come to understand that we are all in this together, that the way to God is through the ways we learn to work together and trust one another. And we must do this in simple, practical, daily ways by following decent rules for human interaction. Freedom and holiness depend on the little laws established in Mishpatim, on the civility that rules require. May we all remember that this week and every week. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Bill Rothschild, a good friend, a rabbi, and a successful practicing attorney in Atlanta, shares stories about his father, Rabbi Jacob Rothschild, and the civil rights movement and MLK, and just how important all that was and remains. Hear it when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Aseinu, aseinu,
Albert Bourla, the chief executive officer of Pfizer, was named winner of the 2022 Genesis Prize, the award sometimes called the Jewish Nobel, and pledged his winnings to projects aimed at preserving the memory of the victims of the Holocaust. The award, which honors extraordinary individuals for their outstanding professional achievement, contribution to humanity, and commitment to Jewish values, was announced last week. It will be presented by Israeli President Isaac Herzog at a ceremony in Jerusalem on June 29th. The announcement noted Bourla's work at Pfizer, which developed one of the first vaccines protecting against COVID-19. Bourla's win was determined by an online vote. 200,000 people participated. I accept it humbly and on behalf of all my Pfizer colleagues who answered the urgent call of history these past 2 years and together bent the arc of our common destiny, said Bourla. I was brought up in a Jewish family who believed that each of us is only as strong as the bonds of our community and that we are called upon by God to repair the world. I look forward to being in Jerusalem to accept this honor in person, which symbolizes the triumph of science and a great hope for our future. The Genesis Prize comes with $1 million. Past recipients, including Steven Spielberg, Michael Douglas, Michael Bloomberg, Natalie Portman, and Natan Sharansky, have donated the winnings to philanthropic causes. Bourla is going to donate his prize money to Holocaust memorial initiatives, with a particular emphasis on the tragedy suffered by the Greek-Jewish community. Bourla's parents from Thessaloniki, Greece, were both Holocaust survivors. Launched in 2013 by a group of Russian Jewish philanthropists, includes current foundation chairman Stan Polovets, the prize is financed through a permanent endowment of $100 million established by the Genesis Prize Foundation. Anti-Semitic incidents counted for 27% of all religious hate crimes in 2020 in Sweden, a study found, where Jews make up just 0.1% of the population. Really disproportionate. Hate crimes against Muslims, who make up about 8% of the population, accounted for 51% of the hate crimes against religious groups documented by police in 2020, according to the Swedish National Council for Crime Prevention report. Anti-Christian hate crimes accounted for 11% of the hate crimes targeting religious groups. In absolute numbers, 170 anti-Semitic hate crimes and 320 anti-Muslim crimes were documented in Sweden in 2020. In recent years, Jewish leaders in Sweden have warned that their community is under threat, both from the far right and from Muslim extremists. Sweden, a nation of about 10 million people, has just under 15,000 people who self-identify as Jews, according to the 2020 demographic study of European Jewry. A lot of anti-Semitism, not very many Jews. And finally, two non-Jewish members of Congress announced the formation of the Congressional Caucus for the Advancement of Torah Values last week, an effort to pledge our friendship to our Jewish friends, according to a statement by the Republican co-chairing the caucus. That's according to a statement by the Republican co-chairing the caucus. His name, I could not possibly make this up, is Don Bacon. Congressman Bacon is chairing the caucus for the advancement of Torah values. The caucus is going to be so important in a bipartisan way, said Representative Henry Cuellar, a Democrat, the caucus's other chair. We have to be able to have the strength so we know what's good, what's bad, what's moral, and what's not moral. Apparently, the purpose of this group is to encourage the study of Torah. Well, that's always a good idea, I suppose. None of the 37 Jewish members of Congress have signed on to this yet, but they have Bacon on their side. Actually, in charge of Torah values, which may or may not include keeping kosher, I suppose. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Bill Rothschild is a rabbi, a successful attorney, and as we heard earlier in the show, the son of Rabbi Jack Rothschild, a crucial figure in the Jewish community in Atlanta and a particularly important figure in the civil rights movement and a friend of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I want you to tell us, you were just a kid growing up then, but obviously you knew what was going on. Your dad was not only incredibly important in the civil rights movement, but was he the first Jewish chaplain in battle during World War II? Is that the story that you told me?
Yeah, he was. And the sort of funny twist of his life was, if he had not come to Atlanta and seen what he saw, he would be known as another one of those war hero rabbis who then had a nice pulpit somewhere and lived a nice life. He's known instead for what he did in Atlanta. And let me give you just a little bit of background. Wars do strange things. They lead to advances in armament and in medicine. And they lead to exchanges of ideas. And, you know, the sons of Japanese in internment camps who went from the Hawaii Territory to fight in Italy came back and said, we ought to have statehood. Sons of black sharecroppers who went from the South to the South Pacific and found that they could vote in 1944, or went to England and found that they could dance with white girls or any girls they wanted to dance with in the pubs over there. When they got back to base, there were actually race riots, but their eyes opened up and they were completely fearless, because nothing that they would see coming home would match the horrors that they had already seen. And I've heard this from more than one veteran who returned. Never from Dad. He was completely silent on that. So anyway, he gets his rabbinical career interrupted by the war. He comes back from the war. He gets asked to this pulpit in Atlanta, Georgia. He gets there in 1946. He actually meets a young woman who was a fifth or sixth generation Southerner and whose great-grandfather had been a rabbi at the same temple, younger than he, born in 1924, marries her. Fall of 1947, Rosh Hashanah, he preaches a sermon very much like Amos going from the Southern Kingdom to the Northern Kingdom. There is an issue here that the South must get beyond it. It is segregation. And he took it a step further and said, Jews have a moral obligation to get involved. Now, take a stop right there. This was the congregation that back in 1913, a 28-year-old then congregant had been accused, we to this day think falsely, of murdering a young 13-year-old girl named Mary Fagan. He gets tried. His sentence gets commuted from death. He gets pulled out of prison and lynched. His name was Leo Frank.
Yeah, of course, which was the source of the foundation of the ADL, of the B'nai B'rith.
In law, it was Oliver Wendell Holmes' dissent there that the court picked up in a later case of granting habeas corpus for a federal review of how a state trial went in a capital case. But back to that, his contemporaries, his widow, I remember seeing, she never remarried, I remember seeing her in the congregation, getting her pointed out to me. They were then in their 50s and 60s to leave the congregation, and the last thing they wanted was to make ways. So here's this rabbi doing this, and he kept doing it. And I think what saved him in the congregation, frankly, was not that he changed a lot of minds, but that there was an influx of other World War II vets and their families who came down, joined the temple, and agreed with it. So let me give you an example of the lighter side. 1954, the Brown versus Topeka decision comes out. Dad decides that he's going to invite Dr. Benjamin Mays, the educational leader of the black community. And the black community in Atlanta had a strong educational system with the black colleges, the Atlanta University system in Atlanta. he was going to invite him to speak to the sisterhood about what this meant. So, of course, one cannot directly say, Rabbi, that's a bad idea. But instead, therefore, he got the concern, Rabbi, you know, that is against the law, because the law is segregated eating accommodations. And you know, we'd love to do it, but I mean, whatever. So Dad's response with a straight face was, do not worry. Dr. Mays will sit at the head table. I will be on his one side. Mrs. Mays will be on the other. And Janice, that's my mom and Dad's wife, will be on the other side, alone at the head table. And all the ladies of the sisterhood will be segregated around us.
Wow. What a great story.
He really had a sense of humor, and I almost lost more than one job because I inherited his sense of humor, but not his sense on when to use it.
When to use it. Yeah, there's that. Tell us a little bit about,
I'm on a roll and I will get there.
All right, Bill, I'll let you go.
So in 1958, the temple gets bombed in October of 58. As an aside, there's a poignant letter from a young black woman who expressed her regret and sadness and noted that when her parents had been bombed out of their home, her father, a pastor, that it didn't make those kinds of waves. And there is a side issue on that. But anyway, at this point, Eisenhower gets involved, the president. It is a huge thing. There's a feeling in Atlanta in the business community that this can't happen here again. One of the reasons why Atlanta advanced beyond Birmingham, which had a stronger economic base in the late 40s, was because of the difference in the business communities in making it clear that bad things weren't going to happen here again. The other, incidentally, was Mayor Hartsfield expanding the runways and making Atlanta the southern airport hub south of O'Hare that really should have been over in Birmingham by geography. But in any case, the temple is bombed. Dad, with that World War II feeling, immediately decides on his sermon. And the temple is in a prominent place. It was literally, it's right next door to the highest spot in Atlanta before the 1950s expansion, and still the second highest spot. It's on the Main Street, Peachtree. So he sticks his sermon up on the board, and none shall make them afraid, right out of Micah. He gets there Friday night. The 1,100 seats are packed. And with a straight face, he looks out. And, of course, that never happens except on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. He looks out and he says, so this is what it takes to get you to come to Friday night services?
I echoed him once by B'Shem Monroe, quoted him right after 9/11. We had that Shabbat, or we had a full house.
Oh, well, thank you.
Same kind of thing. You know, it takes that kind of an attack. Can you tell us about the night that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King came to dinner at your house?
Yeah. Daddy King, who's to us Martin Luther King, not Martin Luther King Jr., and Mama King were important folks in the ministry, and Dad knew them, and Dad was friendly with them, and Dad had respect in the black community. And Martin and Coretta came back from Montgomery in 1960. And at some point, I'd love to talk to you about the Montgomery bus boycott, because it was not a sort of, oh, I think I'll stand up and sit in the seat, and then things happened. It was very well planned. It blew through two stereotypes of black people that don't worry, they can't organize, and don't worry, they're too lazy to walk to work. And it lasted for 381 days, and nobody thought it could. And the young preacher at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, who kept folks going every night through the hot summer of 1956, was Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, he earned his Nobel Prize at what he did then. And he could speak. So anyway, these young folks get invited to Rabbi Rothschild's house, which was a great honor for them. So we lived in a part of town, a nice street back when poor people could live on that street. Our house has been the subject of a tear down and actually a United States Senator from Georgia bought the land and has a much nicer house there now, but I digress. So anyway, so it's nighttime. So they get in late. So Martin and Coretta tell what happened. This is before cell phones. They couldn't find the house. So they have to stop somewhere to ask directions. So they pull up to some mansion, and this is the South in 1960. Martin stays in the car. Coretta walks around to the back and knocks on the kitchen door to ask if someone could tell them where Rabbi Rothschild's house is. And so the folks at that house were not concerned that anything was out of order at all. They just assumed that this couple was serving a party at Rabbi Rothschild's house.
Just amazing. I mean, I would assume that's because you don't want a black male walking up to the front door because somehow that was perceived as threatening.
Yes and no. I think that folks didn't feel the physical threat then that people talk about now because I know statistically didn't exist. The threat still existed the other way of a white man walking up to a black house at night. Incidentally, the house that we lived in had, as did all houses back at that time, a restrictive covenant. They were knocked out by a Supreme Court decision in the middle 1940s. Of course, Jews were forbidden to own the house. And as you can imagine, Afro-Americans were not forbidden to live in the house. They simply were allowed to live in a house like that if they were in uniform. You can't make this stuff up.
Oh, my God. Look, we have a long way to go, but we've come a long way.
So let me jump forward to 1965, 64, 65. It was really great. So in the fall of 64, Martin Luther King Jr. wins the Nobel Peace Prize. And Dad recognized that Atlanta had to do something, and he was on a small committee form to have a banquet. And he's the guy who said, look, this can't be looked at as a civil rights movement. We can't put this over to Pascal's, a restaurant near Atlanta University that was integrated in a great intellectual place. By the way, in 1970, I was working for Andy Young and met Muhammad Ali there. but in any case, he said, it's got to be perceived as an Atlanta event welcoming its son. So they rented the largest ballroom downtown, the Dinkle Plaza Hotel, and there are two stories that go with this. The mayor was with him, Ivan Allen, but he said, I don't know if we can get the business community, which means the white business community, along. So the president of Coca-Cola, I think it was Austin, put the word out in this beautiful Southern language. Coca-Cola is an international company. If Atlanta cannot act like an international city, Coca-Cola may look to move.
Oof.
So the place is packed. The other story is the bowl. So mom is in charge, being a woman, the wife of, is in charge of getting him a gift. So mama says, and by the way, mother's born in 1924. She is alive and well. She gave a great spiel, better than this, the day after MLK holiday for Moment Magazine.
God bless her.
Sharp as a tack. She'll be 98 in February. So she says, Coretta doesn't have time to polish silver. Get him something glass. So she gets a meager budget. She calls up Tiffany, and this is December. The dinner's going to be in late January. And says, this is my budget. And she actually drew something that she wanted to put on the glass. And this can you do it? And so the vice president says, number one, we can't do it for that price. And number two, workers take that they're really busy now for Christmas and everybody gets the week off after that. We never do it in time. So mother tells them who it's for. He says, call me back. She called him back the next day, a couple of days later. And he says, we'll do it for your price. The workers will stay on the job.
Oh my goodness. It's a great story. Bill, there are so many stories. I feel like we could go on for much, much longer. Thank you so much for joining us here and remembering your dad, Rabbi Jacob Rothschild, and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and both of their incredibly important spouses, and for your presence here.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk.
We'll have to get you out here talking in person, maybe next MLK weekend.
Well, thank you, and say hello to your very important spouse.
Of course. and to Brenda. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Yossi Alfer, the prominent Israeli strategic analyst, writer, and author of the excellent new book, Ariel Sharon, Yasser Arafat, and Three Fateful Days in March. Kind of an amazing book, really worth listening to. And don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services at Oneg Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. for services and Torah reading and Kiddush, all live in person and available on our Facebook page. The Torah study is on Zoom. Go to Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson.org for more information. Our playout this morning on Two Jewish comes from Israel, Eden Chasson's hit song, Gadal Li Ktzat Katan. My friends, may you have a healthy week, God willing, a Shavua Tov, a safe week, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
לא בעניינים, איך בכלל פונים חבר'ה צוחקים וחלום שלי שאני יהיה חברים אשכח מזה, אתה לא מספיק גבר ובלב שבר מתגברים ואז הדביקו לי שמות, לא חשוב כמעט שכחתי איך קוראים לי תמיד אהבת
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.